They were able to sell and sell very aggressively through the forcefulness of Giuliani's personality, through a compliant press, through the absence of any contrary data.
New York's declines last year were 3 to 6 times the national average.
It's also now America's safest large city and helping really the rest of the country reduce crime.
In fact, homicides went down and crime went down generally in virtually every city in the country under a wide variety of policing regimes. New York had its own policing theory and its own particularized style. Other cities did things completely differently.
If you don't think I've reduced crime, you got to be living in some other city. But, you know, some people are living in some other city.
But it's in the bloodstream of New Yorkers. It apparently is now even in the bloodstream of Americans. This mythology that Rudy Giuliani single-handedly, super cop, conquered crime in New York City. Rudy gets all the credit. And then when Time magazine did their big cover story and they had Bill Bratton on the cover, it actually cost him his job.
I've just met with the mayor this morning and have given to him my letter of resignation as the police commissioner for the city of New York.
He does rule by intimidation, by fear. That's well known, and he delights to be known as a tough guy.
Giuliani's reputation as a strong mayor is mainly due to his uncompromising approach to policing. So-called zero tolerance has fascinated British politicians.
At least we're doing some things that people all over the world think are worthy of imitation.
Zero tolerance.
So we have more law and order, but massive violations of people's rights.
Police brutality in New York City appears to be a persistent, widespread, and long-standing problem.
And this 1996 Amnesty report, what we found was an increasing number of both complaints, which were lodged with the Civilian Complaints Review Board, and a disproportionate number of people of color who alleged, at least, that they were victims of police brutality. What was interesting is that our report came out in 96 and was dismissed by both the police commissioner and the mayor as sheerly anecdotal, as not worthy of any further investigation. Then, of course, the Louima incident happened.
I don't know what happened to him.
When they got to the station house, he was taken to a bathroom. He was disrobed, all right? And a blunt object was placed in his anus. That punctured his intestine and damaged his bladder.
And you were naked?
They took your
what
pants
happened,
off and took you to the bathroom?
Yes, that was two of them. One pick up something in the floor, I don't know what it is, but it looked like a plunger to me. I could identify only one of them. He tell me, if I talk to anyone about what he done to me, he'll kill me and he'll kill everybody in my family.
An officer would have to be a lunatic to believe that he could get away with what Volpe did to Louima. And yet, he apparently, and several others around him, thought that they could get away with it. They thought we're in our own house, the police station, and within a locked beyond the locked bathroom door within that police station. Who's going to know? Who's going to tell? We can always claim that he was injured some other way. Not that most officers are the kind of monster that Volpe turned out to be, but simply the general feeling that nobody is really watching us.
The Louima incident came up in the middle of the 97 campaign, and it could have turned into a disaster for him, and he handled it pretty well. You know, he didn't get defensive about his record on police brutality. He acknowledged that that was an incident of police brutality and said we're going to investigate it and deal with it. Whether he ultimately dealt with it adequately or not is a different question. And in fact, during our campaign, the Post wrote an editorial that I thought crystallized it perfectly well. There was a charge floating around during the Louima incident that the police officers had uttered the phrase, "It's Giuliani time." And the Post said, if Giuliani time means a little bit of an increase in police brutality in exchange for a dramatic decrease in crime, then we're all in favor of Giuliani time. And I absolutely think that's the message that he sent.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the podcast. Today is the 24th of September. What you've heard so far is a slightly edited clip from a documentary that was released a couple of years ago called Giuliani Time, about one of my all-time least favorite people, former mayor of New York, Rudolph Giuliani. And I will also tell you that I think this film is really just scratching the surface of the story of this man. It does talk a little bit about his background, certainly follows him through his years as mayor, some people might describe as a reign of terror, and also focuses on how he tried to exploit 9/11 to gain political power up to the 2008 presidential election. Can't watch it on YouTube. It has been pulled down due to a copyright claim, but it is available online, and I'll try to find you a good link to put in the show notes if you want to check it out. I use that clip as a preview of a question that we are going to try to answer on the show today. How does an entire society become psychopathic? Now, what do I mean by that? I don't mean that everybody in the society turns into a certified psychopath. What I mean is that because of the accepted power structure, because of the accepted power disparity, because of the lack of reason, because of the lack of any consistent application of moral principles, for a society to have ideologies, practices, policies, that if they were applied to an individual, that individual would be a psychopath. Well, that is a phenomenon which requires very, very, very few actual psychopaths. So hopefully when today's show comes to an end, the clip at the very beginning from Giuliani time will make a little bit more sense. But I wanted to get us started today with a study. It was recently released by Emory University. The findings of this study were published this month in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. And unfortunately, at this time, we cannot access the whole study because it's at APA PsychNet, which is one of those journal sites like EBSCOhost. So, hey, you know, if you happen to be maybe a psychology student, you get access to that. I'd love to see it. But today we are going to be reading a synopsis of the findings of that study from eScience Commons. Title of this piece, Psychopathic Boldness Tied to U.S. Presidential Success, by Carol Clark. The fearless dominance associated with psychopathy may be an important predictor of U.S. presidential performance, suggests an analysis published in this week of the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. Quote, certain psychopathic traits may be like a double-edged sword, says lead author Scott Lilienfeld, a psychologist at Emory University. Fearless dominance, for example, may contribute to reckless criminality and violence, or to skillful leadership in the face of a crisis. And if I may, Scott, suggest your next topic of research, double standards. Back to the article. In fact, fearless dominance, linked to low social and physical apprehensiveness, appears to correlate with better rated presidential performance for leadership, persuasiveness, crisis management, and congressional relations, the analysis showed. Theodore Roosevelt ranked highest in fearless dominance, followed by John F. Kennedy, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan, Rutherford Hayes, Zachary Taylor, Bill Clinton, Martin Van Buren, Andrew Jackson, and George W. Bush. The analysis drew upon the personality assessments of 42 presidents up to George W. Bush, compiled by Stephen Rubenzer and Thomas Faschenbauer for their book, Personality, Character, and Leadership in the White House. More than 100 experts, including biographers, journalists, and scholars who are established authorities on one or more U.S. presidents, evaluated their target presidents using standardized psychological measures of personality, intelligence, and behavior. For rankings on various aspects of job performance, the analysis relied primarily on data from two large surveys of presidential historians, one conducted by C-SPAN in 2009 and a second conducted by Siena College in 2010. The rich historical data on presidents combined with detailed expert rankings provided a window into the emerging theory that some aspects of psychopathy may actually be positive adaptations in certain social situations. Quote, the way many people think about mental illness is too cut and dried, Lilienfeld says. Certainly, full-blown psychopathy is maladaptive and undesirable. But what makes the psychopathic personality so interesting is that it's not defined by a single trait, but by a constellation of traits. A clinical psychopath encompasses myriad characteristics such as fearless social dominance, self-centered impulsivity, superficial charm, guiltlessness, callousness, dishonesty, and immunity to anxiety. Each of these traits lies along a continuum, and all individuals may exhibit one or more of these traits to some degree. Quote, you can think of it like height and weight, Lilienfeld explains. Everyone has some degree of both, and they're continuously distributed in the population, unquote. The results of the analysis raise the possibility that the boldness often associated with psychopathy may confer advantages over a variety of occupations involving power and prestige, from politics to business, law, athletics, and the military. The findings also add to the debate over the idea of the so-called successful psychopath, an individual with psychopathic traits who rises to position of power in the workplace. Quote, we believe more research is needed into the implications of boldness for leadership in general, Lilienfeld says. The analysis found that the link between fearless dominance and political performance was linear, Lilienfeld notes, but he added that at the extremes, boldness might veer into a form of recklessness that would be detrimental. The researchers also looked at presidential scores for self-centered impulsivity, which in contrast to boldness was linked to some negative job performance indicators, including congressional impeachment resolutions, tolerating unethical behavior in subordinates, and negative character. Theodore Roosevelt, for instance, ranked the highest for fearless dominance, but was lower than average for self-centered impulsivity, suggesting that he was far from being psychopathic. Lyndon Johnson, however, ranked relatively high for fearless dominance and was among the top five scorers for self-centered impulsivity. That's consistent with what we know about Johnson, Lilienfeld says. He was a very dominant, socially bold person, at times even ruthless about getting his way. In some sense, these traits may have made him an effective leader, able to push through civil rights legislation, but they may not have been so positive in terms of personal relationships. The end. So yes, let's add this synopsis of this recent Emory College study. Put it right next to that clip from Giuliani Time to preview our discussion coming up on today's show, where it almost seems like the message would be, maybe I'm being a little bit reductive here, but hey, if you're a psychopath, you probably want to get into politics, where all of these dangerous flaws in your personality could be redefined as effective leadership qualities. Redefined by a very subservient intellectual and academic class and a very obedient population, which is in fact a more toxic ingredient in this dangerous formula than the psychopaths themselves. Here we go with the show.
He seems to know just what you like. He reads your innermost thoughts, and you feel like you've discovered a soulmate, a deep intimacy. You're experiencing one of those rare, fleeting moments that makes life worth living. Before you know it, you're involved in a deep, personal bond with a psychopath.
Hey everybody, welcome to School Sucks Live. Today, September 20th, 2012, I'm Brett. In the studio with me tonight, Osborne.
Howdy.
And Corey.
Hello.
How you guys doing?
Doing well, sir.
Yeah, I'm doing all right.
That's awesome. So, last few weeks on the show, I feel like we've had very serious, very agenda-driven shows, you know?
I think so.
And we've been chipping away at our Logical Fallacy series. But because of that, that means we weren't taking as many calls as we could have because we were trying to get through this content that I wanted to deliver. But tonight, open phones all night. Give us a call, 843-JOIN-SSP, or Skype in, School Sucks Live. Either way, we'll take your call. But we'll give you a topic first, too. We are going to be talking about psychopathy. You're doing, put a camera on you. You're doing some psycho moves in music, right? Knifing.
The strings.
Well, these are the things we picture, right?
I was doing the one from the Vince Vaughn shot-for-shot remake,
yeah,
not the original.
Good to do a shot-for-shot remake with the same script.
Right.
In a worst cast. Worst cast. Oh, man.
Okay.
Well, as you can tell, we're going to do a little bit more of a relaxed and conversational show tonight. And we're actually going to be discussing a movie. It's called I Am Fishhead.
Right.
And it is about, you know, how many people out there are actually psychopaths.
Right.
And what can be done about it. I had kind of like a mixed feelings about it. You know, it was hit or miss. Like in some parts, I felt like it really, really hit. And then on some things, or maybe it was just like a sentence here and a sentence there, I felt like there was some pretty significant misses too.
Yeah, I felt it was pretty fairly hit or miss as well. And they made some really excellent points, and then they belabored some other points that were not quite as excellent.
Oftentimes when you're trying to navigate your way through ivory tower academic type things, you have to kind of filter out the blatant communism that's underlying everyone's worldview.
That is true.
Yeah. Now, I think that they always want to make this dichotomy in these types of films between responsible governing and business.
Right.
And I think that that was another one that I thought, because this film talks a lot about empathy, because psychopaths don't have that. But there's another false dichotomy between having no empathy. So I can have no empathy, or I give up comfort and aspiration. Which I think is totally not true at all. Like, you could definitely have both.
Oh, absolutely. And I think a lot of people do.
Sure. The non-psychopathic. But the film makes a very interesting claim, very bold, that the world is run by psychopaths. Now, if you say this to somebody,
right?
I think our government is run by psychopaths. I think a lot of corporations are run by psychopaths. Well, people have this picture in their head, don't they, of what a psychopath is. You kind of previewed that a couple minutes ago with the psycho.
Yeah, a psychopath is a guy on the other side of your shower curtain with a knife.
That movie is called Psycho.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Or every TV police drama is pretty much the plot revolves around some psychopath who's out killing people.
Sure. So we have a man stabbing a lady through a shower in a hotel. We have a man cutting through a bathroom door with an axe. We have a man throwing a chainsaw down a stairwell at a
fleeing hooker. Right.
We have this imagery of what it means to be psychopathic.
Right.
But as we learn from this documentary, and we can learn this other places as well, there's a lot of good research and scholarship on this subject lately, including a book by Michael Cross called Hunting the Psychopath. Mm-hmm. And even though it focuses more on the corporate world. Snakes in Suits. And I know one of the author's names is Hare, H-A-R-E. And he also generated a list, like a checklist, of these are the characteristics of a psychopath. So we'll get into that a little bit tonight. But the first thing I wanted to do is just read an about on this movie that we watched. And we're going to talk about the movie, but it's really just a jumping off point for a broader conversation. And the tagline for the movie is How Psychopaths and Antidepressants Influence Our Society, a Provocative Snapshot of the World We Live In. So we're going to talk more about the whole antidepressants thing in a little bit of detail, but here is the description of the film. It is a well-known fact that our society is structured like a pyramid, like I've been saying on this show, folks, for a while. The very few people at the top create the conditions for the majority below. Who are these people? Can we blame them for the problems our society faces today? Guided by the saying, a fish rots from the head, old Chinese proverb, we set out to follow that fishy odor. What we found is that people at the top are more likely to be psychopaths than the rest of us. Who or what is a psychopath? Unlike Hollywood's stereotypical image, they're not always bloodthirsty monsters from slasher movies. Actually, the nice lady who chatted you up on the subway this morning could be one. So could your elementary school teacher, your grinning boss, or even your loving boyfriend. The medical definition is simple. A psychopath is a person who lacks empathy and conscience. The quality which guides us when we choose between good and evil, moral or not. Most of us are conditioned to do good things. Conditioned to do good things. I don't know if I agree with that wording, but psychopaths are not.
Their impact on society is staggering, yet altogether psychopaths barely make up 1% of the population. It's a lot higher than you would think, though, 1%.
Yeah, because I definitely know more than 100 people, which means I know more than one psychopath.
Mm. You think you know any psychopaths, Osborne?
Yes, I can think of two.
Yeah, I can think of a couple off the top of my head who I'm fairly certain are actual psychopaths.
Broken into three parts, our search for the fish head starts in New York City on Wall Street, where a big chunk of world power is concentrated. The small plot of city land is where economic crisis erupted, and what we found there has far-reaching consequences both for the psychopaths and us normal folk. The second part of the film touches on how, for a small number of people, overuse of antidepressants can result in behaviors that appear to mimic some psychopathic features. Although the overuse of these medications will not produce psychopathy, they may stifle emotion and decrease the user's ability to feel empathy. They also may have the opposite effect, normalizing emotional experience and empathy. More than one-third of the Western population uses and, in some cases, abuses these drugs. But why? So why do we want to take a pill that flattens or normalizes our normal feelings? We think something sure smells fishy again. It is not too far-fetched to say that for the first time in history, we not only praise psychopaths in the highest positions of power, but in many cases, they become our role models. Mm. On top of that, we don't seem to think it's a problem. In the third part, we come back to the idea of us, the normal people in day-to-day life. How much different are we from the average psychopath? By embracing a superficial culture, each of us may be unwillingly supporting the fish head. Albert Einstein said, "The world is a dangerous place to live, but not because of the people who are evil, because of the people who don't do anything about it." Through interviews with renowned psychologist Professor Philip Zimbardo, who I thought was great in this movie.
Yes.
For those of you who don't recognize that name, Zimbardo was the one who did the Stanford prison experiment. Also leading expert on psychopathy, Professor Robert Hare, who wrote the book Snakes in Suits.
And also created the Hare Psychopathy Checklist, which is a pretty standard diagnostic criteria for psychopathy these days.
Excellent. And that's something that we're actually going to be talking about a little bit on the show tonight.
I've got it right here.
Former president of the Czech Republic, Václav Havel. Yep.
He was a playwright.
Yeah.
Before he became the president of the Czech Republic.
Yep. Stood up against the Soviets.
And did it from jail, mostly. Mm-hmm.
Authors Gary Greenberg and Christopher Lane, Professor Nicholas Christakis, among numerous other thinkers, we have delved into the world of psychopaths and heroes and revealed shocking implications for us and our society. So, the world is a dangerous place to live, but not because of the people who are evil, because of the people who don't do anything about it.
I think it's because of a combination of those two things, but yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, if there weren't evil people, there wouldn't be anything to do nothing about. So.
No, that just resonated with me because last week Osborne and I were here. We did a show with Derek J. Freeman, who was the star of that documentary that you were commenting on. We heard the commercial during the break.
Right.
Yeah, like if Starbucks bombed people, I wouldn't go there.
Right.
Wouldn't shop there.
We're very quick to withdraw support from what we see as the bad guys, which for most statists, if there is a bad guy, it's the corporations and never the government itself.
So they'll do boycotts.
Right.
While demanding that the tax base gets bigger.
Like just today, I heard somebody said they're now going to boycott Apple because they're dissatisfied with the new iOS 6 Maps app.
How many people
have
killed?
But they won't boycott the... Yeah, exactly. It may not have killed anybody yet, but it actually, I mean, theoretically it could.
What is it?
The new Maps app in iPhone, the new iPhone OS.
Oh, I see. So like with Steve Carell, you could wind up driving into a lake?
You could.
Yeah, that's no good. Well, anyway, this is a live show that's based on a podcast that I've been doing since 2009. And for much of that three-year history, this has been a show about how to process, identify, and overcome things that have already been done to you. And we took a turn in recent times to pursuing intellectual self-defense.
Right.
How to prevent more bad things from being done to you in the future, because most people, through their training in the 15,000 hours of government school, are sitting ducks for the very kinds of people that this film, I Am Fishhead, tries to bring to our attention. So when I had the guys from Tragedy on Hope on the show a few months ago, we did a show about their movie with John Taylor Gatto, The Ultimate History Lesson. We talked in that show, and then we talked in our Introduction to the Logical Fallacies series about the concept of natural predators. And this is human to human.
Oh, really? Okay.
That some people are the natural predators of other human beings. So I think this is something that, just never occurs to people. Like, that wouldn't be.
Yeah.
Because they think from their own perspective, I couldn't imagine people being like that. But I think this gives us a new perspective to look at that same thing, clinical point of view on this. Through most of the conversations that we have about, you know, corporate corruption or government or, you know, all of these conspiracies, I think those conversations are always fused with a lot of anger and resentment and paranoia and anxiety. And I think to be able to step back and look at this in a more scientific way might be valuable and might diffuse some of that, you know, all of those negative feelings. But, you know, I mean, I told a funny story on the show. This is maybe not the best analogy, but I think it was an after show. And we were talking about snakes and how I just absolutely hate snakes.
This is a well-established fact, yes.
Yeah. And it's not that I'm afraid of snakes. I hate snakes.
Because they're jerks.
And now, I understand that this is kind of a bit, and this is obviously not a totally rational position, but here was the example that I gave. Mm-hmm. The movie True Grit.
Okay.
Which is not even something that happened in real life, but I think it still illustrates this point very well.
Yes.
Towards the end of the movie, spoiler alert, the female protagonist falls in a hole.
Right.
Okay. Now, a hole is a terrible place. Like, who would want to be in some crappy hole in the desert?
Right.
So this is, if you're there, your priorities are not in order if you're just sitting in a hole.
You're having a bad day.
Right. So she falls in the hole, not voluntarily. It's very much an accident.
Well, it wouldn't really be falling if it was voluntary. It would be more of a jump.
More of a jump.
And yet, her day got worse after that, didn't it?
Or a spelunk. Right? So
her day gets worse after falling in a hole.
That's where I'm going with this. Now, anything that's in this hole sucks. Right?
Right.
Anything that's hanging out in the hole and sees this as a good time.
What about treasure?
Treasure is not a somebody, though. It's not a being. Now, I understand that snakes are not, you know, sentient or wise.
Sapient.
Yeah, sapient. Sapient, more appropriately. But then, not just in the hole, there's also a skeleton in the hole. Skeleton of some old man.
Which is a terrible, terrible thing to see when you fall in a hole.
Right.
Because the last guy who fell in this hole did not make it out.
So if you're hanging out in a skeleton anywhere, you're also terrible.
Given, yes.
Out of the skeleton's eye, in the hole, comes one of these snakes.
Not cool at all.
They're the worst. It is irrational for me to be mad at snakes. It would be silly for us to get mad at bears for eating someone's face, because that's kind of what a bear will do, right?
Right.
And I think that what separates these types of creatures from us, aside from intelligence, is conscience. Is that fair to say? Mm. We agree?
Yes.
So when people don't have conscience, when people don't have empathy, they are something other than what we are, and they need to be treated like predators, and we need to talk about ways to defend ourselves from them.
Yes.
Certainly stop participating in systems that lend legitimacy to them. And I felt like in the film, the current United States government and all of its systems kind of got a pass. They talked about the Nazis. They talked about the Soviets.
Did you say Nazis or Nutsies?
No, I'm saying Nutsies from now on.
Okay, good.
Nutsies is a new cartoon that Corey and I are making
right
with squirrels.
Squirrels.
But I really didn't feel like they took advantage of the opportunities that they had, especially when they started talking about the pyramid structure and corruption rising through the ranks, like we always talk about in bureaucracies and police departments. They didn't really cash in on that and apply it consistently to the state. It was certainly hinted at, and Philip Zimbardo is very good at talking about the role that obedience plays in all this, which we are going to get to. But I think that this clinical explanation for the natural predators is something that it might have value for us going forward.
Yeah, I mean, they talk, like you said, they didn't hit that point quite as hard as they could have as relates to the state. They talked a lot about how it's psychopaths running the corporations, but I don't think the average person would have walked away with going, yeah, the president might be a psychopath.
Right.
Well, that's the problem when you're getting this information from academic types, right?
Yes.
They're getting their paycheck from the state.
Yeah.
So how could they talk bad about it? They can talk bad about other states, particularly ones that have existed in the past.
That are gone,
but
yeah.
Not the one that is, you know, feeding them.
That's a good point. But because that's hard to believe,
because like we talked about at the very beginning of the show, people have what they think is a clear and accurate image of the psychopath. Did you say that you pulled up Robert Hare's book?
I brought up a link to the Hare psychopathy checklist.
Okay. Now, by the way, just to tie this into our previous story, the book that Robert Hare wrote was called Snakes in Suits.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So there's your snakes. Do you think we should go through these? I think we should.
Yeah, I think I can. I got it right. There's two important factors that they use in determining whether someone is a psychopath. All right. The first factor is personality aggressive narcissism. Not just narcissism, but aggressive narcissism, which includes glibness and superficial charm. I'm just checking these off to make sure I don't have these. I have superficial charm. Actually, yeah. No, my charm is not superficial. It goes bone deep. Grandiose sense of self-worth.
And I guess what we're asking people to think about here is the political folks, right? The rulers.
Right, right.
All right, so okay. Check and check for them.
A grandiose sense of self-worth. Pathological lying. That's a little harder sell for, like, say, a politician, for example, because when you lie specifically to get your job done, when your job is lying, I don't know. I can see where that would attract a pathological liar. You know, really, the definition of pathological lying is that you lie when there's nothing to gain from it.
Yeah.
These guys are definitely lying for a reason, but for somebody to be that good at lying, that there may be some pathology behind that.
Oh, there's not even a flinch, not even a hesitation in most cases.
They are cunning or manipulative.
Okay.
They lack remorse or guilt. They have a shallow affect, which means their genuine emotion, when they do exist, are short-lived and egocentric.
Mm-hmm.
Callousness, lack of empathy, and failure to accept responsibility for their own actions. Okay, that's just one factor. Factor two, case history, socially deviant lifestyle. They have a need for stimulation or a proneness to boredom.
That's an interesting one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the deviant lifestyle, and I don't want to just pin this all on the political types, because I think this really, really exists in the corporate world as well. And I think that these people are certainly out among us, you know.
Oh, I mean, absolutely.
We're all here in New Hampshire in the Free State Project. Who's to say that a few psychopaths haven't wandered through there?
Are there not degrees of this as well? Like, maybe someone is not as much of a psychopath as the next person?
You know, I may have to read a little, but I think being a psychopath is something you either are or aren't. I think the degrees come in your behavior. Like, just because you're not chopping down a door with an axe to kill your family doesn't mean you're not a psychopath.
Right. Yeah, and that's what that list is kind of showing us.
Right.
But I think that given situations, as they talk about in the film, some people might be in environments, they might have jobs, they might have been raised or educated in such a way or had certain experiences that allow them to develop strategies to tamp this down.
Right.
To keep this under control.
Or like Dexter on the TV show Dexter.
Sure, exactly.
Of course, he still murders people all the time.
But he has some kind of rationale.
He has a moral code behind it.
Right. So that's
he only murders murderers.
That's a kind of control.
Yes.
That he's put on it.
Right.
What about a temporary psychopathy? Like, maybe this week, like, all of a sudden I lose all my empathy and I just want to manipulate everyone and get whatever I can. And then next week, oh, crap. I can't believe I did that.
I think psychiatrically, that would be a more of a psychosis and not actual psychopathy. Psychopathy, mm-hmm. actually, from everything I've been reading, and I wasn't just reading it this week either. It's come up a bunch of times recently, and it's actually a difference in how the brain works, which is widely believed nowadays to be organic in nature and not just some kind of a maladjustment.
I think what you're talking about, too, is more situational or trauma-driven, and I think it's certainly something that is possible, and maybe you describe it as a psychosis. But from my own experience, I know through some hard times in my life, there was definitely situations where I was either ignoring emotions, not feeling things, not processing them thoroughly.
Right.
I think there's a number of reasons for that, but I think a lot of people will watch this film and just have a moment or two where they say,
ooh, am I a psychopath?
Yeah. So I think that there are situations that might turn up the volume on some of these personality flaws that many people might be able to learn how to control. But the psychopath is somebody who is cold and calculating and developing right. strategies to hide their lack of conscience and empathy
right.
in order to prey on the unsuspecting.
Next comes parasitic lifestyle.
Come on, did he write this? Is this like a like some kind of a political commentary?
No, I don't think it was intended to be.
Oh.
He's an academic. Yeah, Chaz Osborne, has rightfully pointed out,
yeah.
that his paycheck comes from the government, so he can't be too critical of them directly.
Most likely. It might not. You know,
yeah, it might not be, but still.
Right.
Anyhow, parasitic lifestyle, poor behavioral control. We see a lot of examples of that in the news. This might be the very best one. Lack of realistic long-term goals. Impulsivity, irresponsibility, juvenile delinquency, early behavior problems, and revocation of conditional release, which I guess has to do with getting released from prison or a mental hospital.
Okay.
And then behaving in such a way that they make you come back.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are traits that are not necessarily correlated to either one of these factors and can show up either way, including promiscuous sexual behavior, many short-term marital relationships.
Sure.
Okay. Criminal versatility, which is one of my new favorite phrases.
Let's elaborate on that real quick. Criminal versatility. What do you take that to mean?
I'm not 100% sure, but I would imagine it has to do with, you know, just being able to mold yourself and fit into any sort of criminal enterprise you might want to get involved in, just because you're that flexible.
I think another thing about the psychopath is they're very much like, to go back to our animal friends, they're like the shark moving forward.
Yeah.
You know, they're always looking for new prey.
It's not actually true, you know, about sharks having to constantly move.
But I'm saying the shark moving forward looking for prey. The shark might stop. He might go backward in real life. But in this case, looking for prey,
right.
he moves forward.
Right.
So they're on the hunt.
Or sometimes up.
Sure.
Sorry, I'll stop doing that.
Oh, that's, yeah. Like in that really movie annoying. Where he ate all those folks.
Or the one where he, like, the giant one jumped out of the ocean and grabbed a passenger plane that was flying overhead.
Yep.
The mega shark. Anyways.
On our show, we also talk about movies directed by Steven Spielberg and sometimes other people. But, yeah, so the shark moving forward... always looking for new prey, and that might not always be just the predator on the hunt. Because one of the things that I saw, and maybe we're coming to it on this list, is a quest for novelty.
Right.
The boredom that you already mentioned, nothing is satisfying long term. So they talk about, you know, going from one victim to another.
Well, there's also, I mean, speaking of sharks, I mean, there's ample evidence that sharks will literally eat anything they can fit in their mouth and or bite into mouth fitting pieces. You know, they don't really, I mean, they do have preferred prey, which is the easier prey to get, but I mean, they've fished up sharks and cut them open and found license plates in their stomachs and stuff like that, like stuff that, you know, why would he eat that? Who knows?
But in this case, it's usually more about power or money, even right. though, like those license plates that the sharks eat, you don't need that.
Right.
It has no nutrients. It has no benefit for you to have more power and more money, but there's like some kind of compulsion or obsession to keep going because right. you need that novelty. I think a lot of people, now you don't have to admit to this.
Mm-hmm.
On one after show recently, we were talking about that website, Your Brain on Porn.
Okay.
And yes. how sometimes people's porn habits sabotage their sexual relationships, right? Because you can't be tapping on your girlfriend and saying, I'm ready for, you know, Asian interracial gangbang in a college setting.
Right.
And immediately have that, right? That kind of novelty keeps driving people forward compulsively, even when they're not even horny. They're not even right. needing to pleasure themselves. So that's not psychopathic, but I think it's a way from what I remember reading in Your Brain on Porn, it's that kind of a behavior.
Mm-hmm.
There's no real motive. And I think psychopaths do, on the other hand, tell themselves stories about legacy and ambition and having right. some kind of destiny. But that's not always motivating their quest for victims.
Well, I think that also tunes into the grandiose sense of self-worth that mm-hmm. we talked about. It doesn't matter if I need it. I deserve to have it and I'm taking it, you know.
Right.
Because they think that just based on the wonderfulness of who they are, that they...
they deserve to have it.
Sure. So what do we get next?
Okay. Criminal versatility, we said, right?
Yep.
Acquired behavioral sociopathy or sociological conditioning. A newly identified trait, i.e. a person relying on sociological strategies and tricks to deceive. So the use of actual learned, practiced, faked sociological in, you know, methods of interacting with people.
So in the film, they were talking about one psychologist, I believe, who right. was brought in to consult on this Nicole Kidman film, Malice. Right.
That's exactly what I was thinking of.
Where she has to play that psychopath.
Right. She said, you have to describe to me a scene from this psychopath's life that someone else might not have seen, a scene that's, you know, not written into the film.
Right.
So he said, what was the scene he laid out for her? You're walking down the street. You see a child laying in the street who's been hit by a car. And the child's mother is there and going through all the emotions and expressing all the emotions that you expect a mother to receive when their child's just been hit by a car. And you, as the psychopath, instead of looking at the child and thinking about how horrible this all is and turning away in disgust, you study the mother. You watch her face, and then you turn around and you walk dispassionately away, go home, stand in front of a mirror, and practice mimicking all those facial expressions the mother made.
Right.
So that if you need to pull that out of your bag of tricks to fake overwhelming grief at some point, you know what faces to make.
Yeah.
That's the sort of thing I think they mean, yeah.
So I, years ago in my career, I worked with young people, and a couple of them were said to have Asperger syndrome.
Right.
Right. Which is a mild form of autism where they are just not in tune or able to process or understand, in many cases, their own emotions, but certainly the emotions of other people.
Right.
Which ultimately translates, even though, you know, it's not their fault, of course, an absence of empathy.
Right.
So they, like the psychopath, are unable to do this. But the psychopath, being more predatory, understands that they have to kind of put on this mask.
Right.
And fake it.
Yes.
And you were saying, too, you were watching, what was it called, with Morgan Freeman. Wonderful show.
Oh, Through the Wormhole with yeah. Morgan Freeman.
I'm remembering something where conscience could be activated and deactivated.
Oh, right. That it's not so much that a psychopath lacks empathy, that their empathy, they aren't capable of it. They are utterly capable of empathy. And in fact, those same brain scans we were talking about, when exposed to things that would inspire empathy in a regular person, part of the brain that controls empathy responds just the same way as everybody else's brain does, but it's under their conscious control and they can turn it off or on as needed to interact with people.
And weren't there other neurological studies also mentioned in that show? Or
the neurologist who was a professor, I spent all afternoon trying to track down this guy's name and I could not find it because I deleted the episode from my DVR, but he was a neurologist at an Ivy League university doing research on psychopathy. And this is something they touched on in this movie as well. They, you know, just showing how the brain scan of a psychopath compared to that of a regular person, their brain responds to stimuli in a totally different way than we do. So there is actually something you can look at, the activity in a person's brain, to determine whether they're a psychopath. And he did a scan of his own brain. This accomplished Ivy League professor did a scan of his own brain and found that his brain worked exactly like a psychopath's brain worked, which led him to the conclusion that, yes, as it turns out, I'm a psychopath. So factor one, all that stuff about aggressive narcissism,
yeah,
measures how well they cover up and integrate all of their violent and antisocial activities. And factor two is the socially deviant lifestyle part, which actually discusses in specifics like what their antisocial behavior is. And if you don't have enough, at least three different traits scored, they score all the traits in this list from 1 to 3. And if you don't have at least three of them rated at 3 in each category, then you're probably not actually a psychopath.
Mm.
Have to have stuff from both factors. Because if you have the antisocial behavior, but not the narcissism, then you're not a psychopath.
I think that something also important to point out right here, which I don't think we've done yet, is that most of the studies about psychopathy took place in prison.
Yes.
So these are people who, chances are, were not as smart as other psychopaths, were not as resourceful, were not as adept at avoiding desperate and dangerous situations, even though psychopaths like dangerous situations. So
that was how more of the focus got turned towards the John Wayne Gacy,
right,
the Ted Bundy types that kind of become, outside of the movies, the pictures that come to most people's minds when we think of the word psychopath.
Yeah.
But
because most of us will go, oh, he couldn't possibly be a psychopath. He doesn't have parts of chopped up women in his freezer.
He's got a tie on.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like for some people, it's that simple.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that adding that checklist into the show was helpful. So now we can see, I mean, geez, you really just described two presidential candidates.
But I think the reason that so many of the studies on psychopaths were done on psychopaths in prison is because usually you figure out someone's a psychopath after they've done something horrible.
Yeah.
Because most psychopaths won't put themselves in the position of being analyzed by a competent psychiatrist. Or if they end up in that position for some reason against their will, they're clever enough and good enough at what they do to fake their way through it. Because if I was a psychopath, I am sure I would know exactly what was on this checklist, and I would avoid displaying any of those behaviors. But once you've already been caught doing something psychopathic and you're in prison for it, the jig is up.
Sure. And if you're a psychopath who's operating at a lower level in the power pyramid,
right,
then it's more likely that you are going to get caught because you don't have all of this public approval,
right,
and tradition and systems and practices kind of normalizing what you do.
The higher you fight your way up the pyramid, the more untouchable you become.
Yeah. So you're a lawmaker or a job creator, just to be fair, you know, just to deal with the corporate world, because I think their examples in the film were sufficient to establish that this is certainly something that is pretty common in the Wall Street crowd. So anyway, I wanted to bring Travis into the conversation. He had some comments about this. Travis, how you doing tonight?
I'm great. Doing great. Thanks for having me, Brett.
My pleasure. So what are your thoughts?
Well, you guys brought up a lot of interesting points. You know, of course, how if someone does happen to have somewhat of a psychopathic mentality, the fact that they can get involved in a bureaucracy that can give them ever more power, where in fact, you know, their whole job is just to keep the whole charade going. You know, as Larkin last week, you know, brought up the whole charade of power, that legitimacy that the government potentially has or apparently has. You know, it's like, it just, you know, your whole job is to keep the charade going, fool as many people as you can, benefit as much as you can. And another interesting point, I was reading actually on Wikipedia the etymology of the word psychopathy. And, you know, it's like you're psycho as in your soul, even your whole being, and then pathy meaning a disease, you know, so a lot of it. In my mind, it's like you get joy out of people suffering. Something about other people suffering, especially if it's in a covert way, some way that you've underhanded somebody and you get this joy. There's a German word called, I'm not going to butcher this, I know, but I think it's called Schadenfreude or something.
Schadenfreude. Schadenfreude.
Schadenfreude.
I don't know, man. Don't ask me.
I know how to spell it. I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce it, but I'm familiar with the term. Yeah.
You know, I always associated the roots, which I believe come from Greek.
Yes.
Path and pass to most strongly correlate with feeling, because roots don't have actual specific definitions. They're more just suggestive of ideas, because right, all these things from ancient Greece and Latin at the time of the Roman Empire, they've traveled through all these different cultures. They've become associated with different things, like the root ambule means to walk, but today we use it as the primary root in these white vans that take people to the hospital.
Right. You know, people who are decidedly not walking.
People always associate auto with cars. Auto means self.
Right,
these kinds
right.
of things. It's like they move through time in different places and different cultures, they come to mean things. So they usually only are suggestive of ideas. So I always thought about path and pass being suggestive of feeling in words like sympathy, empathy, apathy, the lack of feeling, passion. But you say it has to do more with condition.
Yeah, I was inspired by Travis to go to Wiki it.
Yeah.
It's from the ancient Greek psyche, meaning soul or mind, and pathos, which means suffering, disease, or condition. So it's a really very vague term.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I saw suffering in it. Just that word, that German word that we brought up before the break, just really struck home for me. It's like you're just, it brings you such great joy when somebody right. suffers. Like, you know, right. that's just, it's so silly. Like, I laugh at it. But yeah, psychopaths get great joy when other people suffer.
I mean, and psychopaths aren't the only people who feel Schadenfreude. I mean, you know, like
yeah.
being happy when the opposing right. sports team loses counts as Schadenfreude. And it's actually, I just give it up to the Germans for having an actual dedicated word for that concept.
Anything else, Travis?
No, that'll be it. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. Have a good night. Thanks for calling.
You too. Take care.
So with that list complete,
yes,
I think it's time for us to have a little bit of a transition. There was a couple highlights for me. Grandiose sense of self or self-worth.
Yes.
Destiny. Legacy. The quest for novelty. Another one that I saw somewhere else was psychopaths believe that they are the moral standards. That like, oh, what I do is normal. And to think about being the moral standard as well, you know, implies like what we do is right because we do it.
Well, I mean, there's also fairly common for psychopaths to actually not even see other people as people. Like, they are the only real person that exists. And so moral codes don't even enter into it because the people you're interacting with aren't actually people.
Are objects. And this is what yeah. we always heard about sociopathy. And whenever right. I've used that word before, it has been to describe a person who sees other people as means to an end.
Right.
Now, even though we introduced this German vocabulary, which I think is interesting because that's where we're about to go, back to Germany,
ooh.
To answer this question based on those highlights of the checklist that I just read, how does a society become psychopathic? Right. And there's a lot of good work on this subject, also mentioned in the film, Philip Zimbardo and Stanley Milgram. What it takes is, first of all, people who can use their psychopathic qualities or attributes of being right. psychopathic to climb through the ranks. So to make the assertion in the film at the beginning, the world is run by psychopaths, is extremely far-fetched. But then to understand the diversity of psychopaths and like how you could know psychopaths and not even know they're psychopathic, but also with the strategies that psychopaths use, it's easier to see how these people get to the top. So I wanted to play real quick a clip from the film.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine a confluence of events that would lead to Patrick Bateman, for example, becoming president.
Hold that thought.
Okay.
We're getting to Patrick Bateman.
Do you like Huey Lewis in the news?
What happens in an organization is that the psychopath can mimic the high potential.
Now, they're applying this more to the corporate structure, right?
Yes.
How they climb the corporate ladder. But just broaden this out to the phrase we use for bureaucrats and police, corruption rises through the ranks.
Right.
And eventually, because of this ambition, this quest to the top of that pyramid, to the top of the power structure.
And so they hide amongst this group of individuals, and high performers in organizations tend to get more resources, they get more training, they get bigger projects, bigger budgets, more staff, all the trappings of corporate power, which is exactly what the psychopath, who's a parasitic predator, is looking for. And it is unfortunate for the organization on the whole that the psychopath can do this. What happens in that small group is that the psychopath realizes that all of the other high potentials are rivals or potential rivals and begins to take them out through manipulation, lying, backbiting, all of those kinds of behind-the-scenes activity. The organization then begins to lose this cadre of high potential performers. They either leave of their own volition, or they're set up and they're fired, or they're sent to another division where they're, you know, out of the way. And then the psychopath has taken control. So, yes, they do have an advantage because of their personality.
Now, again, this is talking about corporations, but mm-hmm. our question was, how does a society
become psychopathic. I had given some traits from the checklist that Corey read from. Grandiose sense of worth, grandiose sense of self, some sense of destiny, a quest for novelty, whether that novelty is money, power, influence, land, and the idea that the psychopath is the moral standard. We then played a clip showing how a psychopath is able to climb to the top of a power structure. And through those two examples, I think from that checklist, we see many societies, their nationalism, their cultural mysticism.
Oh, yeah.
Specifically, we can talk about the Nazis. Those were all traits of Nazi Germany.
The Nazis!
But we can also see how that becomes possible and how that is a threat to any society. Because, right. Well, you would say this is less than 1% of people, and I would think even a smaller percentage of psychopaths would be resourceful or skilled or have the kind of impulse control necessary to work their way up through that system.
Well, even if it's quote-unquote only 1% of people, that would mean in this country you've got 3 million psychopaths.
Sure.
Out there somewhere. And I'm sure they're not all in jail or in mental hospitals.
Absolutely. We know where a lot of them are.
Right.
Stanley Milgram did this study that Philip Zimbardo references in the film, the Milgram experiment.
Right.
Which was a study in obedience. And it's interesting, that kind of brings this back around, that Milgram was actually interested in how so many people went along with the psychopathic agenda,
right,
of a very small group of people that made up the Nazi party in Germany, the ruling party in the Third Reich. And the ingredient that is so important to understand in all of this is mass obedience, thoughtless obedience, right, blind obedience.
They made it a very clear point to point out that, you know, when you see other people going along with something, no matter how crazy it is, 90% of people went along with, you know, the thing that obviously hurts another person.
Yeah.
Just to follow orders. But if they saw someone else refusing to follow those orders, you were, I think, 85% of people in that case would have also refused.
I think the results were around the same in both cases, yeah, whether the people were just going along or disobeying. But it needed to be like the majority, right? So that also comes into conformity. And there's another great study in conformity. I don't remember what it is, but I'll find it and put a link in the show notes for the podcast, where they have a group of people sitting around a table and they show them this picture of these three lines. Now, most people, and actually everybody at the table except one person, is a Confederate. They're in on the ruse here. And there is one line that is not the longest line, but they say, point to the longest line. And everybody points to the line that is not the longest line. And then the person who is the subject of the study goes last. And you can see the logic, like trying to break through the conformity that they've been trained in, but they, not always, but a high percentage of the time, wind up picking the shorter line.
Yeah, it's, I saw there's a TV show called Brain Games, where it's all about all the ways your brain doesn't work properly. And they set up this scenario. They had a bunch of people on the street, and they staged a scenario where this guy ran up to a woman and stole her purse and ran away. And they videotaped the entire thing. And then they brought the people into, like, you know, into a group to ask them as many questions as they possibly could to try to get a description, accurate description of the thief.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the situation in general. But they planted people in the group, too, to intentionally plant false information. Like, the guy was wearing a white hat, for example. And even though he wasn't wearing a white hat, about 75% of the people, after they were told the guy was wearing a white hat, had very clear, firm memories of the guy having worn a white hat.
I think that speaks more to the conformity aspect of this, that people go along,
right,
with what they see.
And they not only do they go along with it, but they convince themselves that it's actually true.
Yeah.
They were absolutely firmly convinced that the guy was wearing a white hat. And then later, when they were shown the videotape of the incident and saw that the guy wasn't wearing a white hat, their minds were completely blown.
They tell themselves the story.
Right.
So that explains how the society becomes psychopathic, right? And how people deny because they don't want to look at the facts, right? But one of the things about psychopathy is that if the psychopath can't get their way, mm-hmm, they go over the line. right? There, out comes the chainsaw, out comes the axe, even in just a metaphorical sense.
Right.
But last week on the show, we had this wonderful young man, Derek J. Freeman, who did this documentary, Derek J.'s Victimless Crime Spree. And the topic of the show that we were covering was a quasi-logical fallacy called the appeal to force. The appeal to force is not a logical fallacy because it's not an argument. It's a threat.
Right.
If you don't do what I say, I'm going to hurt you. So that's where the line is crossed. Now, am I saying that everyone in the Keene Police Department or everyone at the TSA or everyone at the IRS is a psychopath? No.
But they belong to a psychopathic organization.
They belong to a psychopathic organization because these psychopaths have been able to climb to the top of the power structure and then disseminate systems and practices. And if they're there long enough, even what becomes tradition, these things become accepted. People conform to this. People obey this. And society, even, wow, America, becomes psychopathic.
Hmm. And there's a lot in there about just the adulation of those people as well. You talk about, like, for example, a police department. If you post something, say, on Facebook, saying anything negative about police in general, or even a specific police officer, your fellow citizens will dogpile you.
Yeah, absolutely.
How dare you?
But I wanted to sneak in one more movie into our discussion here.
Ooh.
And it comes back to that line crossing, right? So there's this movie. It's called, also has Psycho in the title, American Psycho, starring Christian Bale. It's about 11 or 12 years old. He's like a savings and loans guy.
Yeah, a Wall Street guy.
A Wall Street guy.
That means to most people.
Sure. In the late 80s,
mm-hmm.
around the time that the whole savings and loans thing was blowing up.
Right.
So then it was, you know, the tech bubble, then it was the housing bubble, then, and, you know, the ultimately resulting in the financial crisis of 2008, which is one of the themes in this film. That's how they bring us to Wall Street. So he is this character who is, as the title implies, a psychopath. But he puts on this polite face. He's able to interact with people in a productive way. But then what's juxtaposed with him trying to go through the motions of having this normal life are these scenes of absolute horrific violence and vanity, like the scene where he's having sex with the two prostitutes and he's flexing in the mirror, mm-hmm. and then, you know, eventually winds up chasing one of them with a chainsaw and he's covered in blood. And then we cut back to a scene where he's putting on a suit and going to work.
Right. And then later on in the film, the chopped off head of one of those women is just sitting in a plastic bag in his freezer. He opens the freezer and the camera really lingers on it. It like really gets right behind him and focuses right on the woman's head. And you think he's like taking it out to do something with it. And then he just reaches past it for a pint of ice cream.
Yeah.
And goes about his business.
Now, there's a lot of debate over the book and the movie American Psycho. Are these things that are actual events in his life, or are these things that he is simply imagining? Because whether it's real or not, we still see somebody who's trying to walk that line.
Right.
Like, I need to fit in to work my way up and through society to find my prey. But then also these examples, whether it's in his head or not, he is trying to toe that line between go to work and fit in so he can continue to move forward on the hunt.
Right.
As the predator and throwing chainsaws.
Well,
but I remember the first time I saw that movie, I thought it was just brilliant how it walks through his routine. And it comes to this one scene where we really see who he is or who he isn't when he's walking us through his morning hygiene. Right.
Right.
And all of his beautification as if it's the most important thing that you're ever going to learn.
I believe in taking care of myself, in a balanced diet, in a rigorous exercise routine. In the morning, if my face is a little puffy, I'll put on an ice pack while doing my stomach crunches. I can do 1,000 now. After I remove the ice pack, I use a deep pore cleanser lotion. In the shower, I use a water-activated gel cleanser. Then a honey almond body scrub.
and on the face, an exfoliating gel scrub. Then I apply an Herb Mint facial mask, which I leave on for 10 minutes while I prepare the rest of my routine. I always use an aftershave lotion with little or no alcohol, because alcohol dries your face out and makes you look older. Then moisturizer, then an anti-aging eye balm, followed by final moisturizing protective lotion.
Grandiose sense of self.
Exactly. And as he's removing a chemical peel, almost like he's taking off a mask, he's saying,
there is an idea of a Patrick Bateman, some kind of abstraction, but there is no real me, only an entity, something illusory. And though I can hide my cold gaze, and you can shake my hand and feel flesh gripping yours, and maybe you can even sense our lifestyles are probably comparable, I simply am not there.
Right. So there is no real person with feeling, with empathy, with anything like that. He is just this predatory machine. And I think they do a good job in that movie and the book of going through the checklist. Right. We remember the scene where there's somebody's has a better business card than him or a better apartment than him. And he's terrified and like, I should kill this person and then pretend to be him. But, you know, that's the line that in the world in which we live gets crossed, because people who are obedient to these sociopathic or psychopathic systems feel like they have license to cross that line if people dare be disobedient.
Wow. Yeah.
It's talked about in the film that most people are good, you know,
yeah.
And most people are trying to move through their lives directed by a conscience, a sense of what's right and wrong. But, you know, being moral, being consistent, being good, and being passive, you know, being 100% compliant,
right,
is in many ways, unfortunately, being pretty much a servant of the predators.
The one thing that it talked about in this film that probably the only thing in the entire film that made me feel like, you know, a little less like the end is near, was they talked about human social networks. And, you know, we're not obviously talking about Facebook or MySpace, but actual humans interacting in person with other people.
Sure.
And how within those networks, moral behavior, and by extension, immoral behavior, reinforces itself. With the people around you are moral, you'll imitate their moral behavior, and it spreads from there, to the extent to which you are connected to other people.
Yeah, this is kind of also, I mean, even though it's a little more hokey, I don't think it's the worst practice to pay it forward, that kind of
right.
idea. And that's like, I didn't like how they were using words like altruism in the film
yeah.
or selflessness, because when you do nice things for other people, there's definitely a reward for you personally
yes.
if you're not a psychopath.
Right.
Like, it feels good to help other people.
Right.
But it's not selfless.
And they went into the idea that you draw people to you who engage in like behavior. So
yeah.
if you're someone who acts well toward people, you will surround yourself with and be surrounded by people who also treat others well, which in the long run will benefit everyone.
But the opposite of right. that is also true.
That's right. also correct.
But the way that negatively mm-hmm. reinforces itself is that if everyone's just kicking each other's ass all the time, imagine two populations, right? One where everybody's helping each other, one where everybody's kicking each other's ass. The one where people are being good is going to benefit far greater than the one,
right.
the other one. And the bad behavior will die off over time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Instead of people just allowing it to the people who exhibit
right.
that bad behavior to be the authorities. And
yeah.
the role models.
Like, we're not really that society where everybody is beating each other up all the time, but the people we look up to in our society are constantly not necessarily beating each other up, but just dragging each other through the mud.
And this is really sad if you do point out how these people are aggressors, how these people are predators, then those people who are the victims of that aggression and that predation go into attack mode against you.
To defend their attackers.
Guy named Plato came up with a story about this some time ago. Plato, P-L-A-T-O.
Never heard of him.
He was a wrestler.
Cool.
And
like the Mexican kind?
Yeah, he was a Mexican wrestler.
A luchador.
It was actually pronounced Plato.
Plato.
Plato. Well, anyway, Plato, the Greek philosopher, if we've confused you, has the allegory of the cave. Are you guys familiar with that?
Yes.
So we have this story about these people who are basically chained to this wall where there's a fire behind them that projects shadows onto the wall, and they watch these shadows in fear and confusion as if that is the real world. One person breaks free, gets out of the cave, sees how beautiful and wonderful the world is and can be for all of them, quickly returns to the cave to tell the people in the cave this story, and is not rewarded, is not thanked, but attacked, because that's too uncomfortable. It means if there is something better that's achievable, we're going to have to take action to achieve it, and that's going to require courage. So, hey, thanks for listening to our live show. We're going to take about a 10-minute break and then do the After School Sucks special. For Jason Osborne and Corey Stanish.
Yes.
I am Brett Finot. Thank you very much for listening, and take care. Remember those walls of fear? Baby, they're tumbling down. They didn't.